Hello and welcome to The Dorothy Project, the interview podcast about women who have a certain connection with gay male society. My name's Alice, and in the next half hour, I'm hoping to find out a little more about what us Dorothys have in common and what's drawn us into this amazing culture. Today, I'm talking to Amy LeMay, the queer culture multi-hyphenate. She is, deep breath, the co-founder of arts company and club night Ducky, a BBC Radio 6 DJ, the author of the first LGBT history book for children, creator of all sorts of art for stage and screen, the co-founder of campaign group RVT Future, and, since 2016, London's Night Tsar. Phew!
What can you explain to me what a Dorothy is? What are the characteristics of a Dorothy?
So, to me, a Dorothy is a woman, or I guess a femme person, who has found themselves a home in gay male culture or society. So I guess I'm kind of distinguishing between a kind of a passive gay icon who doesn't, you know, where it's not a two-way thing, it's just like worship.
Okay, so like Cher.
Well, Cher's given back so much. Cher is a very good Dorothy.
Paris Hilton.
Paris Hilton. Yeah. Like, has she just become this, like, icon?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You're right, Cher gives so much. She really does. Sorry, Cher. Sorry.
Talk to me about, so you grew up in New Jersey.
Yeah, so I grew up in New Jersey. I've been in London, and I've been a proud Londoner for, gosh, almost 28 years now, I guess. I grew up in a small, working-class, coastal, seaside resort town on the Jersey Shore. So geographically, it's kind of where Jon Bon Jovi meets Bruce Springsteen, like in a very special kind of Venn diagram.
I'm getting lots of denim.
Double denim, big hair, long nails, high heels, muscle guys, fast cars, suntan lotion, and I know it was a special place to grow up, and I think that it's given me a really interesting outlook on life, being an outsider. People often say to me, oh, why didn't you just go to New York? It's like, I could see it over the water from where I grew up. But it was like, not just miles away, it was a world away. And I always felt a strong draw to London and a draw to the diversity that this city has. I'd never been here before I moved here, so I just had this kind of a total, you know, glossy-eyed view of what things were going to be like.
And where did that come from? Did that come from, like, culture, pop culture?
It came from music and listening to, like, too many Smiths records and realizing, you know, oh, actually, I thought I fancied Morrissey, but then I realized, I mean, not now, because obviously there's issues, but at the time I thought, oh, I fancy Morrissey. And then I thought, no, actually I fancy girls that look like Morrissey.
It's an important distinction.
It really is. But I think that one thing that was really important to me growing up there was the fact that I had a godfather, my uncle, Tom, who came out later in life. And as his goddaughter, he and I had a really special relationship even like before he came out. And he came out and it was very, very difficult because he was married, he had a child, he had been living a closeted life his entire life. And then all of a sudden, and it was the 80s at the height of the HIV and AIDS crisis. And so everywhere around us was just, you know, stories of gay men dying. It's, you know, all of the horrible descriptions that were given to AIDS at the time. It's gay cancer. It's, you know, it's a plague. It's, you know, and at the same time, my beloved uncle came out, and it was really scary. And then when I came out, my mother blamed my uncle for making me gay. So you think, like, where have I, how have I been kind of inducted in this kind of gay male culture? According to my mother, I was brainwashed. But I really remember that first moment where I went up to visit my uncle in his new apartment in New York City. So he'd been living in small town New Jersey. You know, he went through the Lincoln Tunnel. He went to Manhattan. He got an apartment in Chelsea, and was living his life. And when I was 15, I begged my mother to let me go and visit him. Begged her, and she's like, "No, you're not going. No, you're not going." I was like, "Please, I want to go visit Uncle Tom." And she said, "I'll only let you visit him on one condition. If he comes down on the train, picks you up from New Jersey, you know, from our small town, takes you back to New York, looks after you, and then comes back on the train with you, delivers you to our door." So she was like making it really difficult. And he said, "Yeah, sure, of course I'd do that." But once he got me to New York, he sort of exacted his revenge on my mother through me.
So what did you get up to?
I was 15 and he took me on a tour of all the gay bars of Lower Manhattan. He took me to Splash Bar, where I watched gay men having showers with each other. He took me to, I think it was called Uncle Charlie's Rawhide Bar, like a country western leather bar. Gosh, he took me to this little kind of like gay brunch spot called the Pink Teacup. He took me to the Lesbian and Gay Center. He took me into the men's toilets to show me the Keith Haring murals. And it was like my eyes were just completely like, oh my gosh. And I'll never forget, he took me into what's like a little cafe in a gay part of town or something. And there was this really very attractive, handsome butch woman working behind the counter. And I walked in and she was kind of like, you know, flirting with me a bit. And, you know, me being 15, I was like mortified. And we sat down, we had our tea or whatever. And my uncle said, "She's flirting with you. She really likes you." And I was like, oh my God, you know, like, so embarrassing. It's your uncle. You don't want him to say that. Even though he was totally fine about showing me all sorts of gay gettings up to. Yeah. And so I think it was amazing that he must have seen something in me that he could connect with as well. And that made us very close, you know, from then on, really. It took me a couple of years to come out. But then when I did and my mom said, "Oh, it's all down to your uncle," I just thought, oh, well. I didn't really know what I was doing at the time. You know, it's just like, yeah, Uncle Tom's taking me to all these places. He hangs out in New York.
Yeah.
Then, like, I went back to New Jersey and told, you know, it's like, oh, my God. Mom, don't ask me too many questions.
Amazing. And then how long was it before you moved to the UK? How old were you when you moved here?
I moved to London when I was 21. I just thought, this is where I'm meant to be. These are diverse people. These are my people. And I really needed to be myself, my true self. And so I got a job at a place called First Out Cafe, which was a little LGBT cooperative cafe in just off Tottenham Court Road, just sort of wedged in between Charing Cross Road and Tottenham Court Road. Sadly, no longer there. But that was the first cafe in London without any blacked out windows. That's why it was called First Out. And it was the first openly, you know, no shutters.
Yeah.
Anybody could walk in, kind of gay place.
And anyone can see you.
Anyone can see you and you can be seen.
Mm.
And that was important. That was important for me, but also incredibly important for the people that started it and the people that worked there. And I worked there with, you know, people from all over the world. It's incredible. So came to London and thought, I can be myself. I can be me. And it's interesting when you try and be yourself, how other people sort of react to that. And that's quite interesting because I present as very feminine. You know, I've always worn dresses and skirts and lipstick and, you know, I guess that's, you know, you can take the girl out of Jersey, but you can't take the Jersey out of the girl. Big hair, high heels, long nails, like, and back, you know, when I came over in the early to mid 90s, that was not an acceptable look for a lesbian.
So what impact did that have? Were you sort of sidelined?
Or? I just would get turned away from lesbian clubs. And, you know, there were some gals who ran a club who started a rumor saying, because I was on TV at the time, like as a TV presenter, and it was on an LGBT show, and it was very clear. I mean, I just talked about being a lesbian, so I was just saying I was a lesbian. They started some weird rumor that I was pretending to be a lesbian so I could get on television, and I just thought, if only it were that easy.
That is a reach. Yeah.
So, you know, we all have fixed ideas of what things are meant to be, look like, act like. And when those boundaries are pushed, it can be really uncomfortable for others that feel quite comfortable in their boxes. And so, I mean, I have to say things have changed a lot. But at the time, it was incredibly difficult, especially when you're in your early 20s and you're trying to find your own place in the world. And I think that that is why I wound up making so many gay male friends in London. I really was like, sisterhood, here I am. And then the doors started closing. And I couldn't understand it. And working in an LGBT cafe, there were loads of gay guys there. You know, they were like, oh, darling, I love your dress. Oh, I love your shoes. Oh, you know, the typical kind of stuff. And I wound up moving into a flat share with 6 Spanish gay guys.
And you were the one woman and you were the one non-Spanish one.
Yes.
Amazing.
Then we had 2 Spanish lesbians move in. They were a couple.
Do you speak any Spanish?
No, I mean, the only Spanish I can quote is from Almodovar films that they seem to have on 24/7.
They're great films.
Yeah, in Spanish. So, like, my Spanish is very random and very Almodovar.
How do you think things have changed? Like, did you kind of see that happening? Or do you just look back now and you're like, oh, actually, things are more, you know, people are more accepting of more types of presentation and identity?
I think people now are much more accepting of different presentations and identity. And it was interesting in the 90s, you know, a few years sort of after I arrived, sort of late 90s, there was this lipstick lesbian phenomenon. So that's when you get like the Kiss on Brookside and Anna Friel wearing lipstick. I mean, that was like the ultimate kind of lipstick lesbian moment. And then that became a thing. And then it became like okay to be that. But it was still within the community seen as quite skeptical by some people.
So how would you or did you kind of define lipstick lesbian? Because it's something that people still talk about. And
well, I think it was a media invented way to say this is the quote-unquote acceptable face of lesbianism. And I think it's rubbish. I think it's terrible. But at the time, you know, we had Section 28. We didn't have equal age of consent. Nobody thought equal marriage would have been a possibility. I mean, it was really difficult. Even small acts felt huge. What we would today see as small acts, like holding your partner's hand going down the street or giving them a peck on the cheek in public. And so different times, very, very different times.
So one thing I really wanted to ask you about, because of the title, was your show, Gay Man Trapped in a Lesbian's Body. So tell me about that.
Oh my God. Well, I have been, this is, gosh, I mean, what are we talking about? 1994? 92, 93, 94. I've been writing stuff and sort of reading some bits out, just to like funny things, like to people that I was working with in First Out Cafe. And they're like, oh my gosh, that's so funny. You really, like, you know, you should be on stage. I was like, shut up. Like, no way. Like, I quit the school play because they told me I had to wear a leotard. And I'm like, really chubby. I was like, I am not going to be the chubby kid in a leotard. Like, I will never be able to show my face in school ever again. So I'd never been on stage. I'd never done theater as a kid. Never been in a school play, like, ever. So the idea of being on stage was like, No, not me. They're like, go on, just try it. And at the time, the ICA had a program called Spring Exhibitionists. And every spring, they put on new acts, new kind of live art acts that they wanted to try out and help encourage young artists. So I submitted some of my writing to it. And they wrote back and they said, oh, we'd really like for you to put this on and make it into a show. And I actually had an interview to go and do my master's at Birkbeck in medieval studies. And I didn't go to the interview. And I thought, I'm going to try this. Like, let me do a show. I don't know. It might not work. Who the hell knows? But this seems like a once in a lifetime opportunity. And so I wrote it. Simon produced it and directed it. I'd never done a show. I'd never been on stage. And we did all these kind of innovative, for the time, promotional things. So matchboxes with my picture on it and like gay man trapped in a lesbian's body on the back and, you know, sort of got everybody talking also because everybody was in bars and everybody was in the cafes. It's like, and you could smoke and it was like, oh, wow, did you see this? And, you know, back in the day, like when you used to pick up a flyer or something like that. And so it created quite a buzz. And I sold out two nights at the ICA. And the second night there was a TV producer in the audience and he offered me a job. And the show itself was an exploration of lesbian femininity and how I felt like I had found a home within a gay male society, that they were really allowing me to be me, whereas in the society, in the lesbian world that I was desperate to be a part of and was a member of but felt excluded from, I wasn't able to find a place. And so there was lots of silly camp things in there and a bit of crazy live art with some salt on the ground. And like, you know, it was ridiculous, really. I had a little flamenco number. It was like, you know. It's like a mishmash of everything.
And have you found any other gay men and lesbians' bodies? Like, are there other women who've kind of come up to you and been like, yes, this is my experience too?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I don't know whether now I would say I'm a gay man in a lesbian's body. I think I was, at the time, really struggling with my identity, like so many young people do. And also it was at a time when things were really quite binary and fixed. And it felt like we were up against so much hatred that it was like, you better stick to this definition. And this is what we are. And this is what it is. And this will keep us safe. And in fact, it doesn't. And I think if I were that person now, I wouldn't necessarily have described myself like that. But there were no lesbians really going to see drag shows. There were no lesbians that I knew that were sort of in their spare time making gingham flamenco dresses and sort of wafting around Soho in chiffon headscarves like I was. The only ones that were the queens.
Right.
You know? So I was like, of course I'm going to hang out with them. Yeah.
I feel like that's a good trajectory, right? And then second one-woman show, Come Manifesto, which was for gay men about safe sex, and you debuted it on Hamster Teeth and toured it around kind of cruising grounds for gay men here, Scandinavia. Like, tell me about the choice to make that show.
Yeah. Well, it was during a time when so many of my friends were ill. They were ill, or they were dead, or they were dying, or they were pinning their hopes on combination therapy and starting combination therapy, getting sicker than what they were with, you know, because the early days of combination therapy was so hard on the body. I mean, it was very different, very, very different. And I was seeing my brothers suffer, but I was also seeing them do some really stupid things. And I just thought, come on, guys. But then I realized that one reason why maybe perhaps you carry on having unsafe sex, even though you know that it might kill you, is because you're told that you should die. And you're told that you're no good. And this issue around self-confidence and the right to live and the right to be yourself and the right to thrive, which seemed so radical and so absolutely alien to so many of us queers at the time, but particularly gay men, I think, because, you know, there's always so much in the press and, you know, high-profile people were dying, getting sick. It just seemed like, you know, going to funerals. And so I created a show that I thought, why is all this safer sex information just like being handed out, you know, in places where none of this is really going on? Like, we need to do an intervention. Like, we need to do a direct intervention, like, right as it's happening. Like, I've really felt like going up to Hampstead Heath and going around in every bush and handing out condoms saying, please, stay alive. And so we created a show. We got special permission to do it on Hampstead Heath, which is owned by the City of London. And so, I mean, that just getting the permission for that was like, I mean, beyond. And I did the show at midnight. And I thought no one was going to come because I was there and waiting, and, you know, we lit all the trees. It was really beautiful and magical. And we were doing it in a clearing, you know, clearing that everybody kind of knew. It's like 5 to midnight, 3 minutes to midnight. Like, oh my God, nobody's coming. And then bang on midnight, all of these men just came out of the bushes, came out from the tree, behind the trees. And there were about 350 men there. And I did my show. I don't know what kind of impact it had, you know, but it was one of those moments where it felt like we were all doing something really special. And then I went and toured around other cruising areas and, like you say, Scandinavia. And, you know, I think it's kind of still relevant today, even though medicine's changed. But I think the essential message around well-being in yourself and believing in yourself and self-confidence is something that LGBT people really suffer with.
I mean, we still, like, all of these discussions that were being had about LGBT education in schools, like, just heartbreaking to still be having those conversations.
Yeah, I know. That's been particularly shocking recently, especially remembering when Section 28 was scrapped and never thought that that would happen. And now they're trying to bring it back. And I think that the message I get from instances like that, or instances like in Bermuda, you know, British Protectorate, where equal marriage has been rolled back. Former Foreign Secretary gave his permission for that to happen. And that's heartbreaking, because just when we feel like we've got equality, we must not rest on our laurels. We still must be vigilant.
So we know each other through RVT Future, which is the campaign group to protect the future of the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, which is obviously an amazing place, and it's an incredible group of people. But it is really striking. And we've talked about this, like, in the group. I'm, like, a straight white person, but I also somehow represent diversity, because I'm a woman and we're somehow thin on the ground. Why do you think that is?
I think you need to start a new podcast series. I think women have always fought for their space. Queer women, women of color, women on the margins. And we're still fighting for our space. We're fighting for our space within the spaces that we're trying to save. Things need to change. And what I find exciting is things like the Me Too movement. It really kind of reignited a kind of new kind of feminism, that men have to think about what they're doing. And also, that means gay men. One of the big issues, I think, in LGBT spaces is gay men, some gay men feeling like they can sexually touch women. This is something that has been a part and parcel of my life. Overwhelmingly, the men are, you know, very respectful. But there are some, just like straight men, that once they've had a drink or two, feel like it's acceptable. And what's worse is that some gay men say, oh, well, I don't fancy you anyway, so it doesn't count. At which point, I want to, do something not very nice to them. And that really angers me, because the victim is completely blanked out of that situation. I did go through a phase where, I don't know, for some reason gay men felt like they could sort of feel my arse or pinch my arse. And so I did a little experiment for a while, which was, if they pinched my arse, then I slapped them across the face. And we got so many complaints. I'm a bitch, how dare I, you know, you can't run a gay club, you know, blah, you know, all that, blah, 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 blah. You can just imagine. I mean, this was some time ago. But I felt like I was at the end of my tether and no one was listening. And so I thought, well, I'm going to, when you pinch my arse, this is what it feels like to me. Smack across the face. That is what it feels like to me. So I want you to feel the violation and the pain that I feel. They couldn't cope with that. And so anyway, I stopped slapping them across the face. But it's a problem, and it remains a problem, remains an issue. Or thinking that, oh, well, you're a lesbian, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, these are my breasts, whether they're lesbian breasts or not, has nothing to do with you and everything to do with me. So leave them alone. You know, unwanted sexual touching, sexual harassment is unacceptable in any form, in any venue, in any place, public or private. And we have to do everything we can to eradicate it. And so I'd like to call on my LGBT brothers or GBT brothers to actually step up to the plate and call it out and be an active bystander. So if you see it happening, report it to stop it. And for women, you know, regardless of how you identify, to realize that it is not acceptable. However the perpetrator identifies themselves, it's not okay to have unwanted sexual touching.
I think one of the striking things, nearly everyone I've spoken to has been this theme of not feeling safe as a woman. So I think as a straight woman, often gay bars feel safer because they're not full of strangers.
Safer.
Right.
The.
Yeah. There's a lot in that. Mm. And it's just so depressing when you come to those conclusions that you just shrink into these smaller spaces,
yeah,
in an attempt to be able to find that freedom.
Yeah. And then you have to be put up with a whole host of other difficulties.
Yeah. I don't know if you've had this, but like 99.9% of our crowd at Push the Button are incredible and I love them. But occasionally, regularly enough and similarly enough that I know it's a thing, people come up to give a request and I'm like, thanks very much, or we'll see what we can do. And they just stand there, men, and they kind of like try and get, because I DJ with James and Rob, so two guys, yes, and they try and get their attention.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
it, like, Rob and James are amazing. And
yeah,
just like, Alice is the DJ too.
Yeah. We're like, can you tell the DJ I have a request?
Yes.
Like, I am the DJ.
Yeah.
I'm so at that.
It's just like, wow.
I have one last week. I had this guy who was like, took the microphone off the stage. And I said, give it back to me. And he's like, oh, don't be so bossy. I said, I'm not bossy, I'm the boss.
Your Jersey accent just jumped right out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, right?
It's like, can you see your bias?
We still got a long way to go, yeah, sister.
So, well, on that note, I would love to ask you to nominate another Dorothy I should speak to.
Okay, so it's got to be somebody who has found a place within gay male culture. Well, somebody I've always been intrigued by, but I've never met and have always wanted to, is Animatronic. And she, to me, seems somebody who's like, well, was her dad gay or something?
Something like that.
You know, or whatever, and somewhere on the rainbow spectrum. And, you know, of course, like, she's made so many queer records. And, you know, she has her show on Radio 2, which is all, like, about disco. I just think she's got it going on. And she's, like, a really strong, powerful woman. She comes across as that. And so maybe you could interview her and, like, let me peek through the window while you do, so that I can sort of hang out outside and sort of, like, grab her as she leaves going, hi!
I think she does a Eurovision show as well, and I'm all kind right of, like, any American who's into Eurovision is family as far as,
yeah,
I'm
concerned. Yeah, oh my gosh, yeah, because,
like, if
yeah
you weren't born with that culture and you chose it,
Well, I'll leave it there, but I do want to say that after we wrapped up, Amy and I took it to the bar and spent at least another 2 hours setting the world to rights. I think she's brilliant. I'd love to know what you think. Tweet me at Dorothy_podcast or leave a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want more Amy LeMay, you can find her on BBC Six Music or at Ducky at the Vauxhall Tavern every Saturday night. Next week, I'll be speaking to the multi-award-winning author Juno Dawson. Juno has written loads of staggeringly successful young adult novels and non-fiction books. She's also a school's role model for the LGBTQ charity Stonewall and runs Brighton's queer cabaret night, Club Silencio. See you then.